Basically, I wanted to talk for maybe 20 minutes and pose a question to everyone here, and we can continue it also over coffee. Namely, this question: how we as science journalists should cover disagreements and disputes and controversies and so forth within science. I would say it's probably the most vexing and difficult part of my job, and I've certainly made my share of mistakes over the years, so it's good to get feedback from people and hear what you think I should be doing. It's also, I think, arguably the thing that the public needs to know the most about in science, all the details about ABS and scales and condensed matter and so forth are great, but ultimately the public needs to know how to make decisions on issues of the day that involve controversies in science. So the public needs to have a realistic attitude about how research is really done and some mechanisms that it can make sense of all the disagreements that people have. So I'll try to, in my remarks, identify how the problems as I see them, try to define them more sharply, and then we can get into a broader discussion. So the basic issue is basically the defect of the virtue, that there's a huge diversity of ideas and viewpoints and approaches within research, but people don't agree on things. If you did agree on things, I think it wouldn't be called research anymore. It would be some encyclopedic entry or so forth, and even then it would be uncertain. So I'm going to define this question extremely broadly. I'm talking about controversies and disagreements at all scales, including the kind of respectful disagreements that we might have here in these workshops, but also the kind of more vexatious, whatever, however you pronounce that word, issues of the day on things like climate change or debates that seem to just go round and around and around forever on what does Bell's theorem mean, things like that. And for we non-specialists coming to it, it's remarkably difficult to pick these apart. I think there's actually some, on the spectrum of disagreements, I think there's actually some common issues, and sometimes I think of when we have articles in the magazine or on our website or so forth on disagreements within physics, they can serve as teaching moments for these larger issues that society faces. So here's kind of a tripartite breakdown of the issues at a more practical level for me. First, what is, and actually in all of these three, what is the goal of a science journalist? What's the goal, in my case, of Scientific American, or it could be the case of any other outlet? Unfortunately, Paula Epsel from NOAA couldn't be here, but we did talk about it earlier in the week, and I'll share some of her ideas later. So first of all, I think above all, I'm, as an editor of the magazine and as a writer as well, I try to track what's going on within research. That's kind of my goal, to somehow be the pointer variable for science, just kind of track what's going on within science and attempt to depict it. But obviously there's a selection I have to do with that. I can't cover every single area of research, and that would be kind of pointless. No one has time really to read all that. So there's a choice that's involved, and that's where the disagreements that arise become an issue. How do I choose among the various things I could potentially run articles on? Then there's the question of the magazine and the science journals provide a public service. We're trying to give citizens information that they need to weigh in on issues of the day, understand their diet. Medical research is particularly contentious on these kinds of things. And understand how they should approach environmental questions or cancer treatments or anything else that there's scientific disagreement on. And then there's actually a third part, and research is, by its very nature, disagreement. As I said, it wouldn't be research if it weren't something you were debating about. I'm of the science journalistic school that I don't cover controversy for controversy's sake. That's not a personal interest to me. I'm more of an ideas person. I'm interested in the ideas that people here and elsewhere are playing with. Nonetheless, the fact that those ideas aren't settled is part of research and is part of what the science magazine should be doing, portraying these ideas. And if occasionally there's an instinct to hide the disagreement and just present kind of a unified front, but I think that's a mistake. The fact that these ideas are churning or are not agreed upon is important, and the public needs to know that. So a few particular, and by the way, I'm on the side, you'll notice I've been putting some examples of historical disagreements that occur within science. There was Bohr and Einstein earlier, and and Leibniz, or I should have put Clark here, I guess. And incidentally, if you look at the Leibniz-Clark correspondence or the Bohr-Einstein papers, they're just impossible to make any sense of. They talk past each other half the time, and that's actually one of the issues as a journalist or as a historian in that case you would be faced with. How do you make sense of these ideas if the parties aren't really engaging with one another? So a few ideas about why this is difficult for non-specialists. Try to pin it down a little bit more. First, the process of science is itself quite messy, and I'll have a comment on that in a second. It's often portrayed to the public, and this is something science education, I think, has had to work through in the past 30 years to portray science in a more realistic way. But the scientific method that kids learn in eighth grade or whenever they learn it doesn't reflect, obviously, or isn't at least at most an idealized model for what's really done. But then there's the second issue that, for me, to understand a dispute among specialists requires more knowledge than to understand the individual positions that those people have. So if I talk to Alice and understand Alice's research and I can query Alice about it, and then I go over and talk to Bob and query Bob on his research, and both seem quite plausible to me. Okay, Alice and Bob both have positions, but they're a complete contradiction with one another. That's a higher level judgment I then need to make. It's like subtraction is a noise-enhancing process. I need to subtract their two positions, and then my own ignorance and uncertainty about that will become even more amplified. And then there's the fact that our readers, or any readers, people in general, are coming to these stories with their own template of narrative, of their own ideas. It's a trope in our society that there's this heroic outsider who will ride in and slay the terrible establishment that's trying to suppress them. So that's a narrative you see a lot in Hollywood and also creeps into science writing, I think, unfortunately. Because heroic outsider isn't as heroic as sometimes they seem, although it does happen. But then people also bring their own preconceptions and attitudes. My wife had a bad experience with doctors when she was young and is very suspicious now of any kind of medical research. So she doesn't take vitamins, or maybe she's probably right to do that, but the point is that she doesn't trust the advice that she's given based on her own personal experience, and I think we've all had that kind of personal experience as well. And then you get people in the public who are just sort of cynical about human nature and think you're all doing it just for the money and for grants and so forth. You're in the wrong field, I think, if that's really what your motivation is. So the story that we write, any kind of controversy that we depict in the magazine, will be read through the reader's own lens. I have my own lens, we all do. And it's always difficult to know what one's audience is thinking, but this is a case where it's especially difficult to know what they're thinking and how they'll read something that we do. So let me focus for a second on the first, because I think it's the one maybe we can delve into. And obviously there's a huge literature on this, going back to Aristotle and as things often do, and there's Kuhn, and there's more recent work as well. There's actually an excellent book, I don't know if you've read or given to your students, Scientific Literacy and the Myth of the Scientific Method by Henry Bauer, written about 20 years ago, and it goes through this a lot. And he actually gives examples of the myth of the scientific method. And here's actually just one I took out from a book from 1967. This is actually a published thing for the public about how science is this kind of dispassionate activity, and you're weighing the evidence in a very dispassionate way, which doesn't reflect my own direct observations of it, as it should, because if you didn't bring passion to it, you're in the wrong field.
Is there a typo there?
What?
It says passionate observers. It's not like dispassionate.
Thank you. See, this is a kind of a Freudian slip on my part, isn't it? So yes, that should be dispassionate, exactly. Unbiased by emotions and just not swayed by anything but the most logical. Take Mr. Spock, take his Vulcan side, that's what scientists are, as opposed to the other side of him that came out every 7 years or whatever that was. And I just really for amusement, I took a couple of historical examples about this. Every generation complains about how their own ideas were not listened to. So Kelvin was complaining, I can't remember the specifics here, something in thermodynamics, how the bad logic overpowered the experiments for so long, and people wouldn't listen. But then, for Kelvin himself.
Like a remarkable instance of the tremendous efficiency of bad logic.
No, actually, this is correct. inefficiency, but he means efficiency in the sense of propelling progress forward, that the bad logic hindered progress for those 50 years in this case. I'll look up the original reference. It's typical Victorian language. I'm ellipsing out about, you know, three sentences worth of things. Right. It's this discursive language, but yet, in this case, I think I'm not typoed. I'm not making a typo. But then, Lord Kelvin was notorious. He didn't like, he liked vortex atoms, but he didn't like other kinds of atoms, and he even regarded the discovery of X-rays as probably a hoax. There's another funny example. This is actually, I think Helmholtz was writing to Faraday. Well, actually, probably looking back on what he had written to Faraday, and saying, oh, I can't believe that your ideas of fields were ignored for so long, and it's because they were so original, and so forth. But then Planck sent his paper to Helmholtz, and Helmholtz never read it. So what goes around comes around. I mean, these same issues come up generation to generation. And it's part of what being human is part of the scientific enterprise as well. In other words, I don't say this to mock the people involved. I think, in fact, there was a study back in the 70s, a sociologist did, of the Apollo, the scientists who were studying Apollo rocks, and they interviewed 50 of the planetary geologists and so forth who were studying the Apollo rocks, and asked who were the most creative people. And the people in the sample said, I think X, Y, and Z are the most creative people. Then they asked, who are the most stubborn people? X, Y, and Z, again, were the most stubborn people. So these things are the flip side of the coin. Let me talk about a few other points. And I'm not trying to survey an entire literature. I'm just trying to give a few things that are particularly an issue for a science journalist trying to cover a field. As we all know, every field has its own ways of talking, its own euphemisms and styles. I was talking with some people yesterday commenting about how high-energy physicists and theorists tend to be forward in your expression of your beliefs and opinions, and I think that's great, because sometimes the opposite problem occurs, and people talk in euphemism. It's hard for me to decipher that. I don't really understand that point of view. Might be code for, I completely disagree with that point of view. So I need a bit of disentangle that. I went to a session at the American Astronomical Society, it was probably about 10 years ago, it was down in San Diego, and there was this utterly crazy talk. Everyone in the AAS, if they're full members, has a right to give a talk, and they gave a crazy talk about how, I think it was some astrophysical phenomena was an indication of extraterrestrial technology, or what have you. And the room was packed of people, and I went there just expecting to see incredible fireworks break out, and they gave their talk, and then there was this complete silence, and they went on to the next talk. So if a science journalist coming to that, or a journalist coming to that session for the very first time, I would have interpreted that, or misinterpreted that, as acquiescence in that talk, whereas it was really just put that behind us and get on to the next talk as soon as we possibly can. But you can see how these kind of conventions and etiquettes and so forth might be misinterpreted outside the field. And I've probably been guilty of that myself. Then there's this issue of, and it's not, in fact, it's, I may have to revise this, because at this meeting there's been an enormous amount of direct engagement and direct meetings of the mind. But a lot of meetings you don't see that. People will present their case, Alice will present her case, Bob will present his case, and there will never be an attempt to actually get Alice and Bob to agree on something, or Bob will never query Alice and Alice Bob. So again, someone from the outside is left wondering, how do I interpret this kind of disagreement? You can't really take Alice's position in that case and Bob's and line them up side by side and say, well, point A is contradicted by point A, and B, and just, as an outsider, pick those two positions apart. They're not commensurate. Most debates in science aren't commensurate. Most arguments you give are not things you can just stack up against one another and just evaluate one-on-one. Occasionally they are, but for the most part, my experience, they're not. And this makes total sense. This is something Einstein himself commented on, Duhem and Quine, that it's the totality of a theory's correspondence with the experiment that has to be judged, not the individual elements of the theory. So I think this lack of engagement is part of how research is done, but nonetheless makes it difficult. So one thing often happens is I'm talking to Alice in this case. I'm not going to even use actual names, Alice. And I'll ask Alice about Bob's position. And Alice will say, oh, it's just Bob's just being stubborn. and I'll ask Bob, and Alice is just being stubborn. So they reduce their disagreement to sociology, whereas there's probably, there's a legitimate matter of judgment that's there that they're disagreeing on, but it's just easier to attribute it to people's stubbornness. This happens a lot, by the way, in quantum foundations. It's just unbelievable the debates you get in quantum foundations, or the different interpretations of quantum mechanics, and each one is defensible intellectually, yet, again, that may be arguable, each one seems defensible intellectually, that everyone attributes the other's position to some kind of, you know, they were beat up as kids, or there's something deep in the background. Then there's a lot of what happens, a lot of the intuition you develop in any specialty, in any field, comes from hard experience. You try something, it fails. You try something, it fails. You try something, maybe it succeeds. You try something, it fails, and so forth. It's hard experience. You build up tacit knowledge. You build up just knowledge that's difficult to articulate why you feel something is plausible or not. But then if I ask Alice, why don't you think Bob's position is plausible, it's hard for her to verbalize it because it's not something maybe she can reduce to a set of rules or an algorithm. Hope I'm not going to make any more typos here. I'm paranoid now, but I think I've got it right. Five. Theoretical physics is a target-rich environment. You have a lot of ideas coming at you all the time. So you have to have some kind of heuristics for filtering them, and the reputation of the person presenting it is often one of those heuristics. It makes complete sense. But again, from the outsider, it sounds like almost ad hominem approach to things. So someone who's not sensitive to the need to have some kind of filter on ideas coming in may misinterpret what you say. It's just you don't like Bob, as opposed to you have to have some way of making sense of everything that's coming in at you. And then there's something I call a paradox of skepticism. I'm calling it a paradox even just to be provocative. It's not really a paradox per se. But the idea here is that because most things are wrong, I don't know, you have 100 ideas, probably 99 are going to be wrong. It's easy just to say they're all wrong. It's easy just to be skeptical about everything. We're all skeptical about everything. That's a given. But then how you pick out the one out of 100, that's the subtlety here. And this is actually where I think, and I mentioned this a little bit last time, that although my interest as a science journalist is pretty much aligned with that of a scientist, of you, I'm trying to get these ideas out. They're interesting to me at an intellectual level. There is an orthogonal component to that. And I think it comes out in this paradox of skepticism. I'll set my threshold for an idea that I'm willing to publish maybe differently than you might. Because you're trying to decide whether you want to spend your time on something, which is extremely valuable. My pages in the magazine aren't as valuable to me as your time is to you. I'm willing to throw a few pages at an idea and take up 10 minutes of the reader's time presenting an idea that you may consider not worth your time. So there's a threshold here, and I may let through more false positives as a result, but that goes back to my goals earlier, trying to track what's going on in research, and this is something we can bring up in discussion.
I think experimenters are less frumpies. They have what you're describing, seems mm-hmm. is something that is very particular to theorists. Experimenters doing different, they behave different.
I can see that, and people are excited about one sigma.
If they have some idea that is relevant to their experiment, they usually are less skeptical.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know. In general, I find experimenters and theorists are sometimes.
It doesn't actually affect how they do their experiment. It would be different if it actually affected what they did with their experiment, as opposed to, oh yes, I think this is interesting because it has bearing on my experiment, I'm not really a theorist, which is usually the attitude I get. But if it actually forces them to spend, if it actually forces to spend money and time on that, you know, changing their experiment to sit some theory, then they'll be a little more lucky. Mm.
They would check, so what they would do is they would say, okay, let's check it. Check it in the sense that they would think about it. Well, many times, theorists just
possibly, yeah. No, if they don't know the theory, then there isn't it.
Their criterion is not so much whether they like, whether there's some value that they can assign, whether the theory is correct or not, but whether it's something that is relevant to their experiment. So in many ways, it's more satisfying. The discussion with experiment group can be more satisfying than with theories.
They have another way of eliminating ideas other
yes.
than just saying it's stupid.
Yes, exactly.
But it was very subtle. I mean, the first time you do an experiment and you get something that's conflicting with theory, you presume that your experiment is something that's at fault.
Point number five, of course, it's not personal likes and dislikes, animosities or whatever, but rather the reputation, the experience of listening to a particular person and their record of past ideas. So there's more than emotion involved there. There's a certain logical filter.
I can
also sucks the other way, because I think it's often true that when people have a lot of success, scientists, many times they pass a threshold where they themselves become less critical of their own thinking. They become overconfident in a sense, and then they start. Their reputation should work the opposite way at that point.
But I'm very grateful. It's just a great change of fields and they think ideas of themselves is quite large.
By the way, the amount of variation among different disciplines is just, it's truly boggling. Standards are so utterly different. In fact, Paul and I were talking about this over dinner earlier this week, complaining about archaeologists and anthropologists, where these people won't even be in the same building together, let alone engage with these other ideas together. It's remarkable. So here, five is all, it unfortunately doesn't fall into your rule. There's no, at least what used to be a logical disagreement has grown way past the logical disagreement. Paul actually raised a question that I'll just pose here, and I don't know if I have a good answer to it, but I wanted to put it out. To what extent does the depiction of controversy and just milder disagreement to the public harm science? And you can think about this at different levels. It might lead to decisions about funding that are that vary, but just people's perception about it and whether they want to go into it or kids want to go into it on their own as a discipline. And my own attitude is, well, even if it does, it's not something, these disagreements can't be hidden. They have to be kind of brought out in a way that is true to what they are and makes sense, because if they're not, then when the public does see disagreement, they'll overreact to it and they will think, well, that's an abnormality rather than a normal part of research. And again, I've chosen the hockey stick as kind of a quintessential disagreement within climate science. Sorry?
It's global warming.
Exactly. And Scientific American has had a number of its own run-ins on these kinds of issues. We were going to be sued by one skeptic, then we were going to be sued because we published the alternate view, then we were, I mean, legally sued. We actually had to send a lawyer to deal with this. Then another person on the other side, who we thought we were on the same side, then wanted to sue us. So the whole thing is, this climate science is just so unfortunate because, A, the climate is so fascinating. It's an unbelievably fascinating scientific problem. So it's a shame that it's gotten mired in this. And second of all, it's obviously extremely important to the country, and it's a shame this has come to it, but perhaps inevitable given the implications.
If you want a reaction to this, I agree with everything you said, but still there's some, one has to be really careful about, in education, the preponderance of the science that the public meets, or specifically in educational settings, I think should be settled science. The reason is just that, you know, it's really hard for non-scientific people to understand the distinction between things we really know and sort of everything else. And I find this with my, you know, relatives and friends even that are not scientists. And when I try to sort of say, yeah, we can talk about this and that, but this we really know. And for them, the distinction is blurry. So if we have too many things out there that involve scientific controversies relative to the number that are about settled science, I think that does hurt science.
But almost by
people.
Almost by definition, you know, the media has to present something that's unsettled, or else it's not news. Right? I mean, you're not gonna, you know, it would be great if Scientific American published articles about the Rydberg spectrum of hydrogen, but it's not particularly.
This is a particularly confusing case, because within climate, within the mainstream of climate science, people that I would, you know, multiple people that I'd respect as climatologists, there's going to be disagreements on, at this point largely on details, but they're scientifically interesting and important, you know, issues of, you know, microscale climate, climate at the microscale, stuff like that, which is really hard and interesting. And then there's this overall disagreement over whether the whole enterprise is legitimate in the first place, that is frankly largely between the bulk majority of climate scientists and some small cadre plus paid flacks. Those are two different, I mean, they're two different kinds of disagreements. So this is a particularly confusing one. It's that second disagreement isn't like, you know, the disagreement I might have with somebody over the relevance of LLM geometries, which is in some sense a fine detail.
The trouble is whether or not something is settled can itself be a contentious question.
That's true, and that's hard to pull apart. And you know, and of course, in some sense, nothing is ever, probably nothing is ever 100% settled, obviously. But I'm saying that there is, I think, a qualitative distinction. It's interesting to show the give and take in things. And, you know, and the other debate is interesting, too, but the nature is qualitatively different. One is the, you know, there will always be gaps in a given theory, things you haven't understood yet, things you know, experiments that look a little bit funny, that in the end won't kill the whole theory, but there's something that's very confusing, versus this overall disagreement over the very legitimacy of what 95% of climate scientists are actually doing.
Right, the question is at what point do you sort of excommunicate the dissenters and say, you know, a lot of Americans may disagree with evolution,
right,
and some of them may even publish in creation science journals, right, but we aren't going to consider that a scientific controversy meriting.
It's hard to do. I mean, this is a case where the numbers are so huge in favor of this basic picture of global warming, and a pretty fair fraction of the dissenters are not disinterested parties. Backing from oil companies, in the case of climate scientists, a lot of the players are sort of professional flacks for. They worked for the tobacco companies before that, and they were seriously, it's all
they
the same people.
Job.
No, this is no. this is a case where there's really a qualitative distinction, as opposed to other between two different kinds of conflicts that might arise. And one is about the process of science. The other is about policy and science going against policy.
Did you have a comment?
Well, I would have a slightly different take on Ted's point, which I don't know to the extent that an institution like Scientific American interacts with the general public educational system. But the problem is this controversy is always going to be there, and it's really important in cases like Alvin's describing. People don't know how to think. They don't know how to analyze. And to be able to approach a story of whether it's just about something non-scientific or something scientific, to know what the scientific, what we mean by measuring a number, what you mean by opinion. People just, the education system is so lacking in training people to think analytically. And I think that's more the problem rather than not reporting things until it's resolved.
So how do you think people should be taught or analyze things in
way? The first sweeping thing you do is get rid of things like the MCAS and the standardized testing, which they haven't counted. I'm from Massachusetts, and most of the states have that. In terms of sweeping changes, simple things, that's the first thing. Compartmentalizes learning, that's the fundamental question of democracies, right? How do you educate people to be citizens? I don't have a one-line answer, but it's not what we're doing now.
Climate's one of these. I think this is on topic. Climate's one of these cases where there's a rich, where the data is rich and complex and hard to interpret. And there are a couple of those examples of that. Actually, cosmology is one, where any given measurement is messy and hard and may not, and is subject to multiple interpretations. And it's only after you measure, you know, overlay five different measurements on top of each other. Dark energy is a classic example. It was a combination of And it was a hint from Supernova, it was really a combination of lots of people start to think this is serious. And with climate science, any one measurement or any one simulation is going to be an awful mess. It's a hard problem. It's the understanding that any one is going to be messy, any one can be picked apart, but it's the overlay of a whole bunch of different kinds of measurements in a very messy, different ways of studying a very messy data set.
I agree. One thing I've tried to do personally in covering any kind of climate story is talk not just about single data points such as, or single metrics such as the rise in temperature, the rise in CO2 concentrations. There's an incredibly rich set of data that spans space and time. And they call it climate fingerprints,
right,
that can pick apart or attempt to pick apart different mechanisms for climate change.
There are subjects which are clean where the experiments can be clean, and there are subjects when they're just not. And it seems like that's an interesting story in and of itself. And people, I don't know.
But here's a tricky point in climate. If you have someone just straight out of journalism school, doesn't have a particular background or interest in science, and is asked as a general assignment reporter, go cover this climate scientist. And unfortunately, that's happening because a lot of science journalists have been laid off and or what have you. So I can see from their point of view, there's a legitimate set of, there's legitimate issues. If you talk to somebody who complains about the hockey stick, they did bring up important points about the reconstruction of the data and whether the uncertainties were properly incorporated into this kind of chart and significance was really what people thought it was. So there are legitimate issues, just that when you see them and have gained experience with it over time, again, it goes back to the task of knowledge question, you begin to realize, well, in the scheme of things, that's not as significant as the fact that we have springs coming earlier and glaciers are melting and just the incredible number of data. Did you have a question? I'm sorry.
It's passed.
Oh, I'm sorry, okay.
What is Paula's opinion on this?
Paula thought it does hurt science, and I can't really represent her opinion. That really was in the context of some of these vehement disagreements that came out in anthropology, where Tim White won't even acknowledge the existence of Lucy, let alone its importance in the human family tree. But I think it occurs in other fields as well. I mean, early in the accelerating universe, there's incredible bad blood between Perlmutter's group and Kirshner and Schmidt's group. That, you know, maybe things are papered over now that they all have in the Stockholm, but
that was not on. There was no scientific. There was no science involved in this bad blood.
No, but there's no. They came up with the same values for Lambda. Yes, but Perlmutter was really. And he right. He was upset that Kirshner had been a reviewer on his earlier efforts and had delayed the project.
So Kirshner was upset that he was doing this all his life and Perlmutter got finally the prize. So
I can understand why these are the case. But again, someone coming into it, seeing these disagreements, is left wondering what to think. I'm going to close with just and then we can talk a bit more if you'd like, with a few kind of heuristic tests that I apply. And this is actually, these kind of rules of thumb are, it would be good if I could develop more of them to try to pick my way through some of these minefields. There's one that actually just a couple days ago I decided to call the King Solomon test, based on the splitting of the baby, that whole parable. So when someone comes to me and they admit that they might be wrong, I tend to give what they say a higher weighting because it seems that they're being realistic. Now, I want to give a very specific example of this. This comes from Steven Snyder, the late climate scientist. He sent it to me when I was doing an article 10 years ago or so. And if you look, what he's done here is he's gone to 16 of his colleagues and asked them for their estimates of, I think it was, it was climate sensitivity. So if the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere doubles, what would the temperature rise? And don't take any of these numbers. Things have changed a lot. Don't think it's not whether things have changed a lot since then, but just look at the pattern here. There's obviously a range of just mean values, but there's a huge error bar around them. But notice that number five, scientist number five, is very, very sure of his, and I know who it is, I'll explain in a second, his point of view. He doesn't think there'll be hardly any effect. It's very, very low. And there's almost no error bar around his answer. Turns out, number five is Richard Lenzing, famous climate skeptic. He's the main, and he's a legitimate scientist, atmospheric scientist. But among all the people, he stood out as having the most surety about his own point of view. And again, this is kind of, by my heuristic number one, I would begin to doubt things that he tells me, because he seems so awfully sure about something as incredibly complicated as the climate system. Then there's another criterion that I sometimes use, which is an article useful? Is it provide a public service? Does it educate people? Even if the answer turns out to be wrong. So let me give a specific example of this. Modi Milgram came to us to publish an article on Mott. So, is Eric here? Anyway, we've all heard about Mott, and it was discussed here, this idea that maybe there's some real dark matter that comes out from some modification of, well, the Newtonian dynamics and that theory, but who knows what holds in theory. It's modifying. And it's not a mainstream point of view, obviously. Most people think there is cold dark matter, even at the time that this article was published, maybe 10 years ago. But Milgram's point of view and what he expressed in the article was, here's an interesting phenomenology. Regardless of whether it indicates an absence of dark matter, it indicates something interesting in the universe, that it has this particular kind of acceleration scale where dark matter seems to come in, and in the outskirts of galaxies or clusters or what have you. So he presented it in the article as interesting phenomenology. I personally think it indicates that dark matter doesn't exist, but I'm willing to accept that there may be some explanation within the cold dark matter paradigm for why there's this phenomenology. To me, that satisfied criterion number two, rightly or wrongly. Again, it's a rule of thumb I try to use whether I should publish something that's not widely accepted. Perhaps even more important, though, is, and this goes back to my point earlier about I'm trying to track science. An idea, I mean, who knows if ideas are right or wrong? That's something that's a judgment posterity will make. Experiment, ultimately, hopefully, in fields will make. But at a given time when I need to make that decision, I don't know. And then my criterion is more, does it fit into the context of scientific discovery? Is it something people are talking about? So back in the day when I just had enough time to read the archive, I read AstroPH every day, went through all the abstracts every day, took me about 45 minutes, very proud of myself every day, would read all the AstroPH art. I can't do that anymore. But at the time, what I was looking for were patterns. I was looking for things that kept coming up over and over. Things like connections between supermassive black holes and the properties of the galaxy around them. That seemed to be something that was coming up a lot, so I invited an article about that. Then there's red flags, and occasionally someone will come to me, send Scientific American a proposal, hey, I think you guys should publish an article on X. And it's very persuasive, but then they say, nobody believes X. It's just like Bruno being burned, it's just like Galileo, I had to go recant. And that's just to me a red flag. And whether it's true or not, if someone has to invoke a historical precedent like that, that they're the persecuted scientist, then I begin to wonder. Same thing, if they use the word paradigm shift. Bad. So it's not a hard and fast rule, but if someone has to call what they say a paradigm shift.
Or quantum jump.
Right. If it's a quantum leap or whatever in our understanding.
What if they say it's a paradigm shift, but they're not sure?
Sorry? That's a judgment history will make. Someone has to make that judgment about themselves, you're in definitely in trouble. Anyway, I'll put these up, and I think that's... I had to skip my animation. I just wanted to point out the discrepant data point there. The person's awfully sure about themselves, was the person who didn't think this global warming happened. Anyway, thanks very much.
Question about your practice. I mean, do you have a blog or web page where your readers interact with you? And if so, does that illuminate any of these issues?
Yes. We do have such a blog. The quality of comments can vary, as anyone whose blog knows. But one I deliberately provoked people some years ago. I put out a blog. It's actually early in the history of our blog. And I deliberately solicited, I think my title of the blog was, Are You a Global Warming Skeptic? So I deliberately wanted to bring the people out. And we actually carried on a huge, you can imagine there are literally 1,000 comments for each blog post. It took me hours to go through them every day. And but it was interesting. It was interesting the kind of comments they would make. And people fell into different categories. And they had often entirely reasonable reasons for their point of view. There were some people who were just generally, I think scientists are all bought out, cynical, I think you're all doing it for the NSF grants point of view. Then there were the people who were more specific and had tailored comments, and you actually could engage in a dialogue with them. So it went on for maybe 6 months, this dialogue. And I'll have to send you the link to it, I think you'll find it quite interesting. At one point I tried to categorize into 7 categories the types of responses I was given, try to make sense of it.
I mean, I'll come back to the point I was pointing out before. I mean, as far as, it seems like, you know, you got to the heart of the matter before about, you know, why is it that talking about controversies or disputes would hurt science? It's because of the mindset of the populace that sort of, you know, doesn't know how to react to that. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the education system. Mm-hmm. And I sort of think, okay, well, you know, I'm not going to say anything terribly profound, but if you're taught things like this is the right answer and you're supposed to do the, get, you know, this and this is the right grade and blah, 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 and you're not taught, you know, critical thinking, either about science or about writing, whatever, you know, other countries probably do this better, then I think people come on either with sort of this, you know, very rigid belief in what they believe, or this extreme skepticism because they get this disillusionment, and then now, well, everything's just wrong, you can't trust anything, right? Now, I wonder, and fixing that is somehow is an educational system issue, but I wonder whether if you notice anything with younger people with kind of this more, you know, all these, you know, I guess blog is old-fashioned now, whatever it is people do with Twittering and all this stuff, around the world that there's maybe people are more used to there being a variety of perspectives, like there might be, you know, different ways to govern a country or run an economy or so forth, that maybe people are less, maybe the education system hasn't improved, but that the context in which the younger people are growing up and having conversations might lend themselves more flexibility. Have you seen that at all?
I think that's a really good question. I haven't seen it. And now that you mention it, I'll try to be alive to it. I'm not sure the education system is improved in them, but the type of narrative you see on television is much more sophisticated than it was in the 80s or whatever. So maybe people are used to picking apart complex storylines in a way they hadn't been. It's a good question. I do tend to think that the public can be more sophisticated. It can be very sophisticated in their ability to understand and make fine distinctions. But we have to guide them and to do that.
It shouldn't be just an educational system thing. I mean, it's something where the education system, newspapers, what's left of them, as the joke always goes, more serious journals can all sort of, you know, provide different pieces of how complex a given issue is and how one sips, just a view of the process of sifting through a problem.
I mean, I think there is an education problem, but I'm also hearing what you're saying that I can't blame the education system for that.
I think something like that is something, it's a lifelong learning process, and so you would get a part within the education system, you would get ideally, it would also come partly through good media practice.
Back in my pre-Scientific American days, I invited and published an article on cooking in science, and how the process of cooking is what experimental science, at least, it's a lot like doing experimental science, where there's a lot of passive knowledge in cooking. You have to kind of know that a pinch is this amount, and a little bit, or a dab is another amount. You have to be willing to get things wrong. So the author was describing helping his daughter learn to make cookies, and it took them about 8 go-arounds before the cookies were even edible. But it was a lot like doing experimental science, because you have to be willing to get it wrong and then develop the knowledge through experience. So I think we can, as a magazine or as journalists in general, act sometimes as educators, although, as I can't remember, I think Alex pointed out, ultimately, we're in the entertainment business, so.
I feel like there's, in the magazine report, news reporting, there's actually an important feature of science which can be taught to the public, which is not really in the educational system, Because while I sympathize with Ted's concern that people learn scientific facts that are well established, I think the big problem with our educational system is that it teaches the scientific facts, but not the scientific methods. Mm-hmm. Think about what is in a lab science course when you go in and do the lab science. It's supposed to be teaching the scientific methods. The trouble is it's rigged. People already know what the right answer is supposed to be. And you can't really know what true science is about unless you walk in personally not knowing the answer and wanting to find out through a process of experimentation. It doesn't necessarily need to be unknown to anyone, but it can't be. I think students are deeply confused in the lab, but many of them think they're there to get the right answer. And if they find the wrong answer in the lab, they'll be marked down.
There will be.
Not when I'm grading.
Even when you're grading. If they find that G is up, well, they'll probably mark them wrong.
there's some subtleties here. There's things that are evident in the experiment, but it's genuinely possible to do a good faith version of the experiment and get a wrong answer.
And I take your point. I really do. But how do you think the labs can be modified to allow this more free-form exploration?
Well, there's a lot of work actually going into that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on nowadays in physics education and how to best carry out physics education so that you teach multiple students as much as you can, so that they tend to learn also in labs, etc., how to handle themselves. A number of universities, this is going on at. We happen to have one. I mean, we in fact even hired the Nobel Prize winner, the Nobel Prize for something entirely different. To
like the clickers?
Bart.
Colin. Yes.
I think what's important is to allow students to formulate hypotheses.
The problem is it takes a long time. Making mistakes and correcting mistakes, like debugging computer programs. As you know, when you debug a computer program, it takes you at least 10 times as long as it does to write the thing.
Yeah.
And do we want the students spending 50 hours a week doing a lab? The answer is almost certainly no.
Right, well, that's why I feel like this should be an element of the system. I think more traditional labs maybe should even be a majority of what is taught, but at least some point in, say, a high school science education, one should be exposed to this more free-form kind of science, because it will actually teach them what science is.
I read an article years ago, it seemed like Scandinavian high schools were doing things like that already.
Have any of you tried to use these different discovery techniques in your own classes and workshops? I really need to go to more education meetings and so forth and hear what teachers are doing. So I think I, as a journalist,
because definitely other people around us is really living in that department. It tends to be a sort of person by person thing, as far as I can tell. Still, but it's definitely still something. It's a growing movement to go to a more active learning, what's called active learning model. You'll also see it in almost any NSF career proposal that you read.
I once tried something at a quasi-journalistic level to do discovery, like what you're saying. It was actually a thing I was writing for teachers in my pre-scientific American days. And the question was, why are there seasons? Why are there seasons? Climate seasons. And instead of saying, giving kind of the answer, I actually started by listing some facts, some observations that one could make. That one's relative in Australia, reports different seasons than one does, or things like this, and try to work through the implications of each of those. There comes a point where you do have to kind of make the leap. You can't take discovery all the way through, because there's things like stellar parallax ultimately that I had to bring in as well. But I think we can try to do that a little bit at a journalistic or quasi-journalistic level. Each of the articles we have, I think, has the beginning of the article at least reviews known or more well-established work and maybe some of the experimental or observational techniques before getting into a result. It's harder in theory, because a lot of what you do, it can't really transport the technical process into an article of that sort.
In the spirit of utter hopelessness, can I bring up just one example from the last year? A year ago, we had neutrinos going faster than light, and within days, the initial articles were the responsible journalists went and talked to these guys who said, oh, this may be something earth-shattering, and talked to somebody else, and I'd be very careful, I doubt if that's true. But within days, it was a lot of people saying, oh, Einstein was wrong, Einstein was wrong. Very shortly after that, Wall Street Journal has an op-ed piece from some guy with credentials, you know, some shill off in a think tank, saying, scientists said Einstein is wrong, well, global warming is probably wrong. Now, the total impact out there of all those things, it's only the last that left a residue that's really out there abroad. Nobody knows what a neutrino is. Nobody knows if the experiment was retracted. But, the feeling, scientists are just a bunch of bumblers. It's magnified. Because I hear people ask me about neutrinos, because I once made the mistake of telling my work. Yeah, never mind.
A couple of things. First of all, I don't believe anything I read in the Wall Street Journal, op-ed page, I don't know. The people who tend to read that probably already have that point of view. It's a very particular kind of rarefied place. But I take your broader point that sometimes the perception can arise that scientists as stumblers, and maybe that erodes as all of us worrying about the global world reputation. But I guess my attitude is, rather than try to conceal that, and rather than opera keeping those, the opera is a special case. They probably should have held on to the results a bit longer than ran the test. But in general, when one comes up with a discrepant result, it's good that the public sees it work through and they can reach some kind of conclusion ultimately. I'm not sure if that was a case where that should happen, though.
It's actually an interesting point that very, very good people can get answers that make no sense that are ultimately wrong for some reason.
In that case, I think they released it because it was leaking anyway.
Okay.
So at that point, they either have to come out and say something, or else all these leaks would have been even worse. Then you see scientists suppress the fact.
Oh, God. If you want to either be amused or depressed, you can actually go to Conservapedia, the Wikipedia for the right wing. They actually have a whole section on Einstein, because for some reason, maybe it's connected to global warming. Einstein just says they hate him.
Well, he was a real socialist, right?
Maybe it was just pacifism, or I don't know. But relativity, they actually took relativity as something that...
I think it was a particular person who had who was a fundamentalist Christian, so he had his own sort of alternate science structure.
Okay.
And I assume it was some anti-Semitism.
Okay, good.
And to what extent is Conservapedia representative of a large number of people, though Wikipedia is? This gives the impression, as Alvin says, of just a very small number of people driving things, right?
Yeah, I think it's just fringe.
My impression is it's very, even within the fringe, it's fringe.
Yeah.
And what's worrisome in the global warming thing is that you get, people that are very highly reputed scientists. I mean, people like Robert Austin, Bill Happer, et cetera, who, are very competent scientists, have done extremely good work on it, and yet, are on this, some reason in that particular area, are on this strange other side. And I don't know how we're journalists handle that, because...
One should always be careful of people who jump fields. I mean, Bob Austin's a biophysicist. Bob Austin's a biophysicist, he's not a climate scientist, and so that would be the first red flag for me.
Richard Feynman is a particle physicist, not a biologist, and he did some really nice experiments in biophysics. I mean, physicists especially tend to be pretty...
I wouldn't say that it's real. For me, that would be the point where I was careful. And when someone's just sort of jumping fields largely, because I've seen that
a lot. Sure.
It's the...
Well, were they really jumping fields, I mean, out of whim, or was it, I thought they were responding to the APS and making a statement, and they were saying, look, when I was reading APS...
Austin has actually come out and said he much more specific things about global warming, as a report.
Yeah, he doesn't believe it. He doesn't...
All the simulations...
It's not clear to me what link he doesn't like, but I tried to find out from him, but I couldn't.
Yeah, it's very tricky, as you say. And again, if you take any individual case, any individual piece of the climate puzzle, of course there'd be questions. One could always question models or data sets and so forth. But again, to me, it's the totality has to be judged. It has to be judged as the totality. It's, I don't know. I don't have a good solution to it. I think Scientific American has just erred over the years in this, claiming that there's consensus on things when there's not, in fact. So that can be actually more damaging in the end.
Can you give an example?
So during the Lomborg, when the whole Lomborg book came out.
The which?
The skeptical environmentalist. That, again, skeptical environmentalists fail my jurisdiction number one. The chapter in that book on global warming is extremely asymmetric. It gives a lot more weight to Lindzen's ideas than it does IPCC ideas. So, in any event, I think what we should have done at the magazine was invite an article by Lomborg and then had a series of articles dissecting it. What ended up happening in the end is that we didn't have an article by Lomborg, we just had the articles dissecting it. So it looked like this broadside of attack on Lomborg, which it was, but it wasn't sensitive, I think, to the rhetorical impact of that. So a lot of people, our readers are contrarians. I think most of us in the room are probably contrarian by disposition. So when you see that, your immediate reaction is, well, I didn't hear Lomborg's side of it. Why are they attacking him? So I think that was an example where we should have given Lomborg's side of it. And again, it was, in a sense, you might consider it to be false balance because he was presenting a minority's point of view. But I think rhetorically, it came across as suppressing him. Any thoughts on how I should be covering things at this meeting? At least the black holes sessions that I'm going to do. It's fascinating, but sometimes I think I need to let a lot of the science develop for another year before.
Do you have controversy there?
There's controversy, which is good because if everything were settled, then why would we be having the workshop? But in some cases, I think I need to hold on to some of the ideas for.
Well, in this case, I think one important thing is any account of it should include a historical perspective so that readers have a concept, a sense of how long the discussion has been going on, which also helps to indicate sort of how deep and difficult the questions are so they glib answers. It's not really something that's going to be resolved, I think, super quickly. And probably that will be helpful to indicating the depth of the issue, is to indicate the time that people are discussing. But also how alive they are, the fact that we would all want to come here and do it again. And it's not like there isn't discussion. There's passionate, a lot of activity still trying. So it seems like there's a lot at stake.
I've enjoyed a lot of the discussions that have gone around. And they've been very sharp, and people have really been engaging in a direct way, which I haven't seen at that many other conferences I've been to. Maybe a conference has a different etiquette than a workshop does.
Conferences are for presenting your ideas and where you are at the present, not hashing out disagreements.
Yeah. Any other thoughts, ideas? We can go grab some cookies.
Yeah, just a quick one. I mean, it just occurs to me that, isn't there kind of like a rather sizable industry in science journalism that's sort of skeptical in nature, like, don't believe the numbers you see and don't, statistics lie and so forth. And of course, I mean, those are all making valid points, but do you see those as being, I don't know whether that plays into your concern here about sort of a legitimate scientific, messy scientific process coming off as, you know, looking illegitimate?
You mean, are there science journals you're just...
No, 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 I'm just wondering whether you see any sort of connection between those two things. I'm just talking about that in my head, maybe not.
I guess at the individual level, individual science journalists might come with that point of view that they're trying to debunk things and then apply that to everything. John Tierney at the New York Times, I think, does that a lot. Basically, anything he writes, you can assume that he disagrees with. He has a certain contrarian template that he applies, and it works for some subjects, and unfortunately, he also applies it to climate, so I think it doesn't work for that. John Horgan is also like that. He tends to disdoubt everybody he listens to or talks to, which is it's prerogative, I guess, but kind of unfortunate, I think. It's at least into some directions he may no longer go in. I think there's a lot of contrarians in science journalism, and it's
less of a science journalist trait than a journalistic trait. I mean, there's a number of op-ed writers who I think do have that kind of shtick. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, I discussed a little bit in my first talk, a lot of science journalists are coming from more of a journalistic direction. They started as journalists and then maybe reanimated or developed an interest in science and then moved into science journalism. Whereas some of us come from the other direction, really. And they were in an environment, initially I had friends who worked at like Forbes and CNN and so forth, but they're in an environment where they're constantly, you say something, they question, you say something, they question. So it's almost a knee-jerk reaction. And, I mean, I being skeptical about things, claims in the world is a good thing, but sometimes it can go too far. Anyway, thanks for coming and offering your comments.